on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Tech giants call for the end of government snooping, someone hijacked the internet, and securing your mobile data. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 70, recorded December 9th, 2013. Securing your mobile data. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/Twyatt and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasier, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not here to guide you by myself. I've got an all-star cast, starting with, in studio, the man to my right, Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise who is currently freezing his buns off here in San Francisco. Brian, welcome back to the West Coast.
Yeah, just a little cooler than we're used to. By the way, chat room, Chi Tu, my wife, is in audience along with CyberDog, and they're already in the chat room and making comments.
They're making comments, and they're going to let you know what's going on behind the scenes. A man who does not need to know what's going on behind the scenes because he knows all is Mr. Curtis Franklin. Now, Curtis, stop me if I'm wrong, but you were supposed to be on a plane right now. What's going on?
Well, there are things that are beyond even the Twyatt Riot's ability to control, and the weather's one of them. I was supposed to be flying to Austin, Texas for Dell World, but the weather in Texas has pretty much shut down all traffic through DFW, so American Airlines decided that we should all stay home. We'll try it again tomorrow. So if you're waiting on me in Austin, my apologies. I should be there tomorrow night, and until then, I'm happy to be hanging out here.
Fantastic. So we've saved by ice. I like it. Now, also joining us is a longtime friend of the show, Mr. Lou Maresca of Microsoft. Lou, you were just on the Twit TV network last Friday as part of our Coding 101 beta. It is a pleasure to have you back. Now, for the people who maybe are just joining us now, it's been, 20 episodes since the last time you were on Twyatt. You want to explain a little bit about what you do at Microsoft?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a developer at Microsoft. I've been here for about 10 years, and I've been in all types of products from the Dynamics, which is the ERP or the enterprise resource planning applications, business apps, to web apps, to phone apps, to tablet apps. And right now I work on Dynamics CRM, which is a customer relationship management software. And I'm at where I work today in my sunny faux window that I have behind here.
Is that a real atrium, or is that one of those?
It's pictures. A real atrium.
It's a real atrium. Wow. Yeah. Microsoft must be rolling in the bucks. You know, I love small companies, so good on you. Now, let's get straight into it because we've got an action-packed, news-packed episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Our Enterprise Bite starts with the internet has been hijacked. No, seriously, it really has been. Now, there was a vulnerability in BGP. That's the Border Gateway Protocol. That's essentially the protocol that runs the internet. That's how packets find out which routers to go through as they're going around the world, as they're routing around the world. Back in 2008, two researchers showed it wasn't really a hack. It was just really the way BGP was created, a way to hijack traffic to make it route through your routers so that you could sample, sniff, copy whatever the traffic before sending it onto its destination. And there was really no way for the receiver or the sender to know unless they were closely paying attention to the routes that their traffic was taking. Now, Chibert, do you want to explain a little bit how BGP works? We had it on an episode of Twyatt, but what's the Cliff Notes version of what BGP does.
So the easiest way is you say, Mr. Router, I have such and such networks right behind me. And the unfortunate thing is everybody trusts this. BGP has been such a rare skill that up until, God, very, very recently, BGP has not even required a whole lot of authentication. So what happens is, like, for instance, I actually had this one case where I was trying to download some drivers from Spirent, which is less than a mile away from my lab. And because someone had made a mistake, they had fat fingered a BGP configuration, my path actually went through Chicago before it came back to Honolulu just to go a mile away. Now, that was a mistake. Once you get past the mistakes and someone wants to do this maliciously, you can start doing some really interesting things. All you have to do is either answer before the correct guys or be before the correct guys and answer before they can answer.
Right.
Not hard.
Yeah. So essentially what you're doing, it's almost like a DNS attack where you're just screaming at the other router saying, oh, no, that particular computer, that particular network, I'm right next to it. I'm really close to it. I'm the guy you should be routing your traffic. And all the routers will actually trust you. Now, this attack was used specifically to intercept traffic from government agencies and from certain corporations. It routed the traffic through Belarus and Iceland, which is interesting. And then the traffic was dropped over to where it should arrive, and they didn't notice it for months and months and months. Now, I want to go over to you first, Curtis, because this could be looked at as government spying, a little bit of traffic monitoring, but this attack could just as easily be used by corporations against other corporations. If you really want to find out what your competition is doing, why not just reroute their traffic? Is this something that you think the enterprise world is aware of? They know that this is actually possible?
Well, until this last week, I would say that most people in the enterprise world had no idea that BGP existed. For most people, even in the networking world, BGP is deep juju. I mean, this is, as Gbert has told us, some pretty serious stuff. The people who are really good at BGP are few and far between. The thing is that on one level, this attack has all the sophistication of the comedy theft movies where people just go around putting up detour signs for the armored car to follow and get lost on their way to the bank. It does depend on trust. And most people in the executive ranks have no idea it's there. They don't want to know that it's there. This is one of the more arcane protocols to configure. What it does show is that we still have an internet that is living on the protocols developed at a time when it was a fairly small, closed community. And it's no longer that small, closed, trusting community. And we need to do within our enterprise things to protect us. I think that we're going to get into a lot of those in just a bit, but it reinforces the notion that in transit, unless you're on a completely private network and away from the internet completely, you have to assume that your data is insecure.
Right, right. And it's a good thing that you mentioned that there are very few people who are experts in BGP. We've actually had one on the show, Mr. Brandon Ross. He's one of the avowed masters of BGP. He does it for Interop. So anytime we bring up our network, he's the guy who has to publish our routes so that other routers around the world know where they should be sending their traffic. Now, I want to throw over to you, Lou, because this is one of those things that I think Curtis started to mention it. It's sort of the twilight of the original generation of the internet, where everything was open, everything was trusting, everything was as easy to understand as possible because we wanted the network to grow. Now that the internet is more or less mature, we know how the transport layer works, we know how to best route traffic, those early decisions about how to create these protocols seem to be really, really nearsighted. How do we fix this?
I think, well, the first thing is education. Right now, like Curtis said, BGP is transparent to everybody. So no one really knows, understands where things are going. No one ever looks where their stuff's getting routed to. I mean, I don't. And again, you're only only good as your weakest link. And so the legacy protocol in this case is the weak link here. So it makes sense to maybe modify some of the protocol specifications at first and then educate people, maybe build some more tools, maybe build things in operating systems where they are able to detect if things are been rerouted or a current route that they're following, if it's the most performant route or if it's the most secure route, that kind of thing. Because normally packets can come in on a specific route. There's lots of things you can potentially do, but I think the first thing is to educate people, especially around secure data and how it's being routed.
Right. Cheaper, let me throw over to you because I've heard comments before of, well, why can't we alter BGP so that I could choose, as Lou mentioned, the most secure route? You know, is there a switch I could throw to say, look, only route through routers that I know are trustworthy, even if that's going to increase my round trip time, or to be able to throw a flag and say, I don't care where this goes, just give me the fastest route and go.
Actually, I asked this exact question not too long ago because Server 2012 R2 now can talk BGP natively. The idea is to be able to go and advertise your internet domain and more easily set up branch office VPNs with a lot less hassle. The problem about BGP, though, is that if you don't have any controls in place, a newbie can very easily, let's just put a one in there. Well, that means you are the authority for these addresses, and all of a sudden you have the entire internet's worth of traffic filtering through you. Kind of a bummer. So there's a lot of filters and a lot of ACLs that a lot of BGP wranglers just put in by default. So you can't advertise that you're the root of the internet. You can't advertise that you're the root of .com or .org or .edu. So BGP has a lot of filters already in place. It's all a matter of getting these people to learn how to put them in place and learn how to modify them safely. BGP, unfortunately, is not well taught, not well known. And, you know, I've actually been trying to learn it now for about 5 years, and it's hard to get the wizards of the internet to go beyond, well, BGP is easy. No, it's not. It's actually hard because there's not a lot of well-published information about it. It's not like, say, OSPF or RIP or something like that where everybody and your uncle has put up a website about it. BGP, everybody assumes you have experience, and that's kind of a bad thing.
Yeah. Web7303 in the chat room, in a kind of ham-handed way, has basically said, wait a minute. All IT types know what BGP is. And I think both Curtis and Brian are right on this, which is even if you know what it is, you don't have any ideas for securing it. You can't secure it. In its current format, that protocol can't be secured. And so a lot of IT managers don't include that on their list of vulnerabilities when they talk to their executives, when they talk to the department managers, because there's nothing you can – there's no equipment you can buy. There's no way you can reroute your network in order to make that secure. The only thing you can do is encrypt, which is why we're going on to the second story of our Enterprise Byte series, and that is – that the tech giants have called for the end of government snooping. Now, it's a bit more complicated than that, but we've got a webpage here, which I love this. If you notice, if you go to this webpage for the global government surveillance reform, there are 8 companies that have banded together, including AOL, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Twitter, and Yahoo, to basically say, look, we need to reassess the way that we allow governments to oversight network traffic. But they didn't use the DNS system. They actually used an IP address. You have to go to 97.74.205.113. And it's kind of a little jab on exactly how insecure the internet is. Now, the thing about this is it kind of feeds on the stories that have been building for the last year. We know that everything electronic is getting snooped on, from your cell phone to your browser traffic to your email to your VoIP traffic. And yes, even you gamers, we know that the British government has been watching the World of Warcraft servers for traffic, for patterns. It's too easy not to snoop. That's why they're snooping. Well, what these agencies have done is they've gotten together to ask for a transparent and accountable method of monitoring the global flow of information across the internet as an essential part of a robust 21st century global economy. I want to throw over to you first, Curtis. This is one of those things where we've got these companies that are not telcos. So this is not AT&T. This is not Sprint. This is not Verizon. These are the companies that are actually providing the content saying, look, we've been stuck in the crossfires for way too long. You governments need to get together and decide how is it best to responsibly monitor the traffic flowing across the globe of the internet. Is this a real call? Is this a PR stunt? Would this actually spark anything, or is this just bits in the ether?
Oh, whether it will change anything, I think, is open to great debate. I wouldn't count on that. I think it is an important PR move for this company, these companies, and it's a PR move that's aimed at people outside the United States. I think a lot of these companies and a lot of cloud-based companies have seen people, international customers and potential international customers, who have said, you know what? We're worried about the United States government in its various guises looking at our traffic. We'd like to try and stay as far away as possible from that oversight. So we're going to try to stay away from American companies. Now, we all know that just because you're away from an American company doesn't mean that the NSA can't look pretty much everything you do. It is important, though. It was fascinating. I was listening on my way back here from my less than successful attempt to go to Austin today. Pardon me. I was listening to Alan Dershowitz in an interview, and he was talking about the importance of the balance. Certainly, we want to keep the bad guys out. Even as enterprises, we want to keep the bad guys out. But we also don't want to go to a system where it's okay for the government to look at everything we're doing. As he phrased it, you hear some people say that if you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't worry about it. Well, when I have intimate relations with my wife, I'm not doing anything wrong, but I certainly don't want the government watching. And I think that's an analogy that a lot of enterprises are starting to use in terms of saying we don't want someone looking at everything we do, even though we know we're not doing anything wrong.
Lou, I want to go over to you because your company is one of the companies that signed on to this petition. Microsoft is a big part of this. And Microsoft has good reason to complain because they've taken so much flack. They were caught in the crossfire way, way, way back. They were one of the very first companies approached by the FISA court, the secret courts, and said, look, you have to comply. You have to turn this over. And they actually fought it. They put up a much bigger fight than any of the other companies that have signed on to this. And so they're kind of tired, right? I mean, Microsoft is tired of getting beat around. They want to say, look, if you want to request this data, please own up to requesting the data and stop making us look like the bad guys.
Yeah, I think it's important because especially if you look at the list of people who are in on it too, I mean, Google, Apple, it's pretty much the people who own big data streams today. I think that's the key here is to, in order to force reform, you've got to starve the data source. And so if the government agencies keep coming and asking these companies for data, if you can just say no or give them a good fight so that they have to, you know, fight harder to get the data, then you're starving. And in that case, it forces them to try something else, especially if it's critical. And I think that that's kind of the key. So it could be a PR stunt, might not be. But I think, one of the things to notice, too, is there's no ISPs on the list. So, you're starving people who are using systems and data and search. But there are other things that are not being starved in that case. And so there might need to be some additional reform on that side as well.
Right. Chibert, I want to throw over to you. It's notable that no telco signed on to this. There's no Sprint. There's no AT&T. There's no Verizon. So the carriers, the ones who are actually moving the traffic from one router to the other, maybe they've given up. They know that they're not going to be able to get any reform. My question to you is this. Could these companies individually, which do account for a large amount of the traffic that flows over the internet, at least the sensitive traffic, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, if they were to decide to do end-to-end encryption so that it didn't matter what flowed over any telco link, it could not be read without massive amounts of power to decrypt, is that in itself reform? If the players behind the internet decide we're going to encrypt all the traffic so the government doesn't have easy access to it, does that fix the problem?
You know, it fixes a symptom. It certainly does that.
Good start, yeah.
But why should we have to? I think that's more of the real problem. You know, do we want to fix the disease or fix the symptoms? It might be enough. It might be a good move. One of the things that a lot of people have talked about is, you know, if you only encrypt the important stuff, then you know what to decrypt. If you encrypt the shopping list, then you're just going to have to make your opponent's work a lot harder. I think it actually really might help as far as things like discovery. You know, there's been so many abuses of this the discovery process that maybe encryption means, gee, if we had rotating keys and we changed them on a regular basis, maybe you can go and say, hey, Mr. Lawyer, I'll give you the key for this set. You can't have anything more because that's outside the scope of your discovery.
Right. Curtis, I want to throw to you because I believe you have that little mantra that you've used on Twiat many times. What is the key to security?
The key is to encrypt early, encrypt often, encrypt everything. If you care about it, if you don't care about it, if it's going to be something that exists on, in, through, by, around your computing devices, encrypt it. It's not foolproof. We all know that if the government really, truly, desperately wants your information, they have the resources to put to work to break the encryption. But there can be satisfaction in making them work awfully hard for that information.
Yeah, I like it. Lou, I want to give you the last word because, you know, I love having you back on the program. When we start looking at this coalition, so we've got these eight companies, I can only believe that it's going to expand. Slowly more companies will come on and say, wait a minute, this is a good idea. Rather than us taking the hit, make governments responsible for transparently requesting data if they believe there is a legitimate security risk. Is this something that you want to get a critical mass of? Is this something that you'd like to see 30 companies, 40 companies, 100, 1,000 companies sign on to and say, look, we want to provide this service, but if you want to protect the economy based on an internet that's free, you need to make sure that it's free. Is this something you see moving forward, or this is a one-shot deal?
I mean, I hope it's not a one-shot deal. I mean, it's kind of a coalition side of things. The more people you have, the more the movement will to kind of go forward. I mean, the thing is, if you starve the data sources to these government agencies, there's no way that they can move forward unless they reform some or make some changes somewhere. And so the more companies that get in on it, the better. And I'm going to say that once people start seeing these big companies kind of put up the fight for them, these little companies will come along as well, and kind of hopefully join the coalition, because that will also help with the reform, as well as they don't necessarily have to put that initial fight up like these other companies did. And the companies on the list, if you notice, they have pretty good amount of money to do the initial fight. So I think that some more people will come along sooner or later.
I hope so. Now, coming up next, do you have these little flash drives? You know, they used to be kind of oddities. Now they're everywhere, and now they're huge. This particular one holds 32 gigabytes. If you use these to transport sensitive information, you're going to want to stay tuned for the next segment of This Week in Enterprise Tech. But before that, let's talk about the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot. And of course, that's RingCentral. When Leo built this place, he decided that we should dog food. We should do the thing that we've been telling our listeners for years and years and years, and that is to move everything into the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. Our calendar is in the cloud. Our scheduling, our file sharing, everything we possibly can push into the cloud, we've pushed into the cloud. Which is why when our IT guy, Russell, told us that we could get a cloud-based phone system through RingCentral, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. Our producers love getting their voicemail through their emails, and it's just that simple. RingCentral also offers the ability to send and receive faxes straight from your email, PC, smartphone, or tablet. New faxes will arrive in your email inbox so that you can always stay on top of your business no matter where you are. You can preview and print faxes, design cover sheets, and even sign faxes electronically right from your computer. You'll never have to use one of those bulky fax machines again, although you may miss that wonderful, annoying grating sound. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try RingCentral and see if maybe it is the right solution for your business. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time, just in case the NSA is listening, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. We've got a special guest, Mr. John Terpening from Kingston. John, welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's good to have
Thank
Kingston
you for
back.
Having me.
Yeah, yeah. You guys are, well, I'm going to say it, you're storage, you're data specialist. And here they're going to talk about a very important issue, an issue that's near and dear to our hearts, and that is data security. Especially in this holiday season, especially for business travelers, it's far too easy to load one of these things up with an amazing amount of data. What's the problem with that?
Well, obviously, these are very popular devices. Everyone has one. And a lot of corporations, people are free to walk in and out with USB drives, carrying all their data around. What we found, a lot of our companies, a lot of our customers that have used our products now have started with policies requiring the use of encrypted drives. We offer a complete line of that, and these are hardware-based encrypted drives that are easy to use and encrypt all the data on there 100% with AES 256-bit encryption. So when the drives are lost, your data is protected.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because I understand these are your data travelers. And most manufacturers have some sort of product like this, which is essentially a USB flash drive that has some sort of encryption program that needs to run in order for you to be able to access the data. But is that the best practices model? When we talk about data in general, needing to take data off your network, taking it offline so that I can work, let's say, on an airplane or a place that has limited connectivity, is this really the best way to do it? I mean, what would be the Kingston stand on how workers should be expected to take data away?
Well, yeah, first of all, you want to make sure your whatever security policy you implement is minimal invasive in the way your employees work. So USB is used, it's popular because these are it's an easy way to transport your data. You keep it in one place. You can move it at your work computer, bring it in, work on a file, take it off, up in the air on airplanes, and at home, just as easy to access. So employees are going to use those USB drives. The solution here is just to make sure that that data is secure at all times.
Right.
And these drives, again, having the hardware encryption is built into the drive. There's no way for the employee to work around it. It's 100% encrypted. They can't use the drive in an unencrypted mode.
Yeah, right. Let me throw over to you, Curtis, because he makes a good point. You know, we know that we should encrypt our data. We know that the drives should all be secure. But can you convince an executive that he should use an encryption program? Can you convince that marketing manager, that IT manager, that IT exec that he should have an encryption program built into every device that he might possibly plug his USB drive into?
Well, I think that if the application is transparently encrypting everything, then probably so. What you're going to have a real problem doing is adding a step for much of anything to the routine for an executive or even most busy managers or salespeople or healthcare professionals. They feel like they're busy enough. The computer is a tool. They want it to be as simple as possible. So I think that if you can set a policy to require the existence of an application that by default encrypts things, you have a shot. If you're asking them to manually decrypt things, you're done. That's just going to be a non-starter. So it really depends on how ubiquitous you want to make the application as the IT manager for this fleet of devices you're covering. If you want to make it a matter of policy for anything that connects to the network, you have a shot. If it is voluntary or complicated in even the most rudimentary fashion, then you're going to have a true problem with compliance.
All right. I want to throw to you, Lou, because Microsoft has actually had an encryption program built into Windows for quite a while, yes?
Indeed. Yeah, Surface RT even has BitLocker turned on by default. So,
and how often does that get used? Do you have any stats on that?
You know, I don't have any what they call SWIM data, which people, you know, customers who sign up for that, they can send out data on if they use it or not. But I know that, you know, it's required by us on all of our mobile devices, even on any of our, you know, hard drives or flash drives or whatever. And it's kind of a key, like, as long as, like Curtis said, you should be encrypting early, like right away this way, especially with SSD drives today. You know, it's really hard to kind of zero out those drives and flush them or erase them. And so if you don't have encryption enabled early, you know, if you were to ever sell the device or, you know, recycle that device, people could pull data off of them. So it's kind of the key is with Windows, BitLocker is huge. If you turn it on early, it's easy to turn on and it's transparent to you. So it's kind of the key to any of those encryption systems.
Achieve it. You've worked at a university and, you know, supposedly with very tech savvy students. Why is it that you think more people don't turn on encryption by default?
They're lazy. Okay. No, that's the bottom line. They're lazy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the unfortunate fact of life is a lot of these encrypted devices are really expensive or really slow.
Okay. That's actually good. John, let me go back to you because that actually is a common complaint that, well, I don't turn on BitLocker because, well, it takes up resources, because it's slow, because every time I encrypt something, I have to unencrypt it, or because it's messing up the performance of my system. If we could go to the product shot, you sent us a few of Kingston's devices. These are your data travelers. Now, these just use an encryption program, right? You run a little encryption program on the computer that you're going to install it into, and it'll encrypt the data, and you have to have that client on every computer you use it on.
No, let me clarify that. So first of all, the encryption on these devices, these are hardware encrypted.
Oh.
And what that means is there's a encryption engine built into the security processor onboard the drive. So there's nothing to do but just set up a password the first time you use it. After that, every time you plug it in, a small launcher program comes up where you enter your password and it mounts it like a regular USB drive. However, these drives do all that enforcement. There's no unencrypted partition. Data can never be stored on these drives in an unencrypted state. So if you force your employees or require your employees to use these drives, there's no way they can use these drives in an unencrypted state. The impact on them is minimal. The only difference is they got to enter a password to log into the device when they insert it. After that, you use it like a regular drive. Now, we have many of our customers that have implemented these programs have used their existing endpoint software on their computers to block all standard USB drives, and they'll come back and whitelist just these Kingston drives. Right. And what that does is that enforces it. If a USB is going to be used within their organization, it's going to be one that's encrypted.
We've got two good comments in the chat room, one coming from Web7303, who's asking, well, would the encryption engine in one of these be OS agnostic? I mean, if it's hardware, it shouldn't matter what OS it's running on. And the second question was from Max1234, who said, well, can I bypass the encryption engine? For example, would there be a way for me to desolder the chips, put them onto another board, and get past the encryption front end?
Okay, yeah, both very good questions. Let me deal with that second one. There's no way to bypass that encryption engine because if you desolder the flash chips themselves, the data stored in those flash chips, in those storage chips, is cipher code. It has to be decrypted. So the only way you would do that is be able to take that data, move it back through the AES algorithm, and you would have to have access to that encryption key, the 256-bit key. That's protected within the security processor. So there's no way to bypass the encryption. There is no way to use these in an unencrypted state. There's no mode built into that so that these can be used in that state. The encryption's always on.
Okay. Yeah, as Mooncat in the chat room has sarcastically said, no, you just solder the chip in backwards and it just flows right out. Now, what about the second question? Because we are getting a lot of people in the chat room who want to know, well, does it work with Linux?
Oh, okay. The encryption itself is agnostic. To access it, obviously, you have to enter a password, and that does require a program. So built into these drives, there's a small CD-ROM, virtual CD-ROM partition that has both Linux, Mac, and Windows compatible program. So when you plug it in Windows environment, that program will autoplay. And again, it's a very simple program. You enter your password and click enter, and you have access to your data. But it does require running that program, which is built in. And again, that program, we have versions all built in the same drive that are can support across all three OSs.
Now the chat room is going crazy. I think we can clear this up. Yes, it is OS agnostic. It will work on PC. It will work on Mac. It will work on Linux. All you need is that client, the proper client, to be able to give you that password prompt so you can access the 256 AES encryption for the data on the drive. Now, John, I want to go one step further because these are great. I mean, if we go back to the product shot, these are all drives that use that hardware encryption. They use an encryption engine so you don't get the performance hit. They use an automatic encryption engine so that you don't have to, as Chibert said, you don't have to worry about the lazy factor. But then you've got this. This is kind of the buzz in the business traveler world. This is not just an encrypted drive. It's an encrypted managed drive. What does that mean?
Sure. The managed drives are ones where they allow they're compatible with a centrally managed console. So an IT department can set up this console. When the drives are first plugged in to the enterprise network, the drive has a small client program on board that goes out to that console, establishes connection with it, and registers that drive with that end user per their AD credentials. From then on, that can be managed by the central console. So they can remotely lock these drives. They can see history of where the drive's been used. If they need to get access to the drives too, in some cases where they want to see what their employees are storing, they can actually have access to that data.
Okay. Let me go around the horn here a bit. Okay, Lou, let's go back to you. So we know that BitLocker is included in Windows builds, Windows 7, Windows 8, Windows RT. If the encryption is actually built into the drive, does that make it an easier sell for Windows users? And let me go one step further. I know you don't have a crystal ball over there, but would Microsoft consider perhaps building in functionality for some of these hardware encrypted drives to make it just a little bit easier for people to know that their data will be secure on those types of devices?
Yeah, I think anytime you do make something transparent, as well, you know, in making it secure but transparent, the adaption's easier. So I think building into these operating systems, these abilities to do these things, especially when you already have ARM devices already shipping with this capability turned on, people don't know it's there, and they just don't realize, but hey, their data is already secure. So that's kind of the key there. But I think that's kind of the key is working, maybe creating some kind of a specification that OS is at the very core level can support these hardware scenarios. It sounds like a good idea, because obviously then if they're not using one system but they're using another, they can still make it transparent enough for users to make it easy for users.
All right. Curtis, I want to go over to you, because it would seem to me, if Brian would cut back over to my product shot, that this solution, the whole idea of encrypted, that's a no-brainer. I mean, you have to start with that, right? I mean, you if you don't use an encrypted drive, you're just asking for trouble. I mean, would you agree with me to say, if you're running an enterprise and you're allowing workers to take information offline on a USB drive, at the bare minimum, it should have hardware encryption?
Oh, absolutely. Because if you look at where some of the major problems have come in the past decade regarding data loss, quite a few of them have been simple lost devices. They didn't require any criminal activity whatsoever. Having a heavily automatically encrypted removable drive is a prudent, reasonable, and doable step to minimize the problem from these lost devices, minimize the problems from theft. I cannot imagine an enterprise that would not provide this kind of device or require that their employees buy them and use them if they're going to support removable drives at all.
Okay. Now, let me ask you one more thing, Curtis, and that is going up to this level. If Brian cuts to my product shot, this was the managed drive. This has been the holy grail for a while, which is a hardware encrypted drive that I could, say, wipe remotely. The reason why I bring this up is I had a very interesting email over the weekend from a former college classmate who told me about traveling to China, about how he was traveling with a bunch of USB drives. And on the way back, he noticed that some of the scratches that were on his USB drives no longer existed. So he figured, whoa, wait, so someone took my drives and replaced them with the exact same model, exact same color, but this is not my original stuff. What would it be worth for IT managers to be able to give their execs something that they could, say, remote wipe or be able to know if, yeah, did you come back with the same drive that you left with?
Oh, I think that would be remarkable because in the same way that a lot of companies require the mobile wipe capability on mobile devices that they allow onto the network, requiring it from removable storage devices is the next step. It's something that that the prudent enterprise should look at requiring now. There's nothing magical about it. There's nothing onerous about it. There's nothing that adds to the burden that's being placed on the user. It's something that's reasonable, that's prudent, and that's a major step towards security when mobile devices are involved.
All right, Chievert, I want to get your input right before we jump into a break. And that is to say, does this solve the laziness factor? I mean, I say this tentatively because every time I think a new product has come out that solves the laziness factor, there's another level of lazy that sets in. It used to be, oh, floppies are too hard. They're not big enough. Then we got hard drives. Oh, hard drives are too clunky. Then we got USB drives. Oh, USB drive. I don't want to run the client. What is the complaint now?
Well, it certainly gets rid of a lot of the complaints. But one of the things that we kind of missed on this is the fact that we can now use these types of drives for two-factor authentication. That's a pretty big deal. Just about every major university on the face of the earth is looking at 2FA or MFA, multi-factor authentication. And I actually started asking the question of a couple of friends over at Microsoft and said, hey, you guys have been using those smart cards forever and ever. What you guys do to read and write them? What do you guys use for printing and things like that? And they said, you know, funny you should ask that. We're actually starting to deprecate smart cards and putting a lot more credentials into TPM chips. So having something that's simple like this to provide 2FA or MFA plus secure storage plus the ability to remote wipe starts looking like a perfect storm of a good defense for the road warrior.
I got it. Now, John, I just want to warn you that we're not going to let you off easy. When we come back from the break, we've got some really good questions from the chat room, including RSX11M, who asked questions about the chain of custody for the actual hardware. I'm going to bring you back. We're actually going to vet you. We're going to go down through everything that you've built into the secure management tools to find out if maybe, if not Kingston, some other type of drive might be the perfect bet for our data security. But before that, I want to take some time to talk a little bit about the second sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that's TechServe. Now, you know that we're all about the enterprise. We want to reach out to the enterprise users, to the enterprise executives, to the enterprise IT people, and even to the people who just want to know how enterprise tech works, which is why I'm so happy we have TechServe, because they bring in a very important piece, and that's Apple. As New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe has the range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the U.S. Whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started, from sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. And some amazing technology solutions have already been deployed on iPads. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, you may have noticed nearly every seat in the terminal is now equipped with an iPad. Travelers can sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on those iPads, or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year alone. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction of all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company that's behind Delta's terminals. They've turned to TechSurf to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads. And it's a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechSurf, well, it really was the natural place to turn because they sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects. It's what they do. From the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechSurf is able to do full lifecycle management for all your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and maintaining them so that they're always working efficiently. TechSurf also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise ever has a problem with your solution, help is just a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? Here's what we want you to do. If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, then contact TechSurf today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techsurf.com/quiet, and TechSurf will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techsurf.com/quiet. techsurf.com/quiet. And we thank TechSurf for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it, John. You've given us a nice rosy vision of what it means to have a hardware encrypted USB drive. Now, you know, our audience is really, really sensitive to people coming on and acting as shills. So I don't want to let you off scot-free. We had a really good question in the chat room from RSX11M who asked, and let me quote here, "If you want me to have faith in this hardware encryption engine, I need to understand the chain of custody of manufacturing. For example, is the chip made in China? Every time I've been sold an embedded secure solution, it's turned out that there's a hardware backdoor." John, what kind of assurances would you want to give a customer if they came to you and said, "Look, I just want to know that when you give me this drive and I'm going to put all my data on it and suppose that it's secure, that it's actually secure"? Has there been thought that has gone into that chain of custody?
Definitely. That's a very good question. And nowadays, just about all your silicon is made in some place other than the U.S. Taiwan's a very popular place for most of the world's silicon coming out of it. The chips themselves are fabricated over in Taiwan in foundries there. However, we have all the manufacturing here in our U.S. facility, and this is a Kingston owned and operated facility, actually where I'm located right now.
So
that firmware is loaded here and the software is loaded here, so we have control of that process here. So with that, it probably gives us better control than anyone else would have over their security, the fact that we build it and we do the firmware load here in our own facility. Furthermore, we also do use third-party security experts. We will give them samples of our drive to see if they can hack it or find vulnerabilities that we may have overlooked. Those are available to our customers under NDA, so a lot of our enterprise customers will do that. And then the last is, as they always say, trust but verify. I would encourage anyone, regardless of the security system they get, where they get it from, is to use third-party security experts to test it. Again, we can provide those reports, but they're welcome to get a third party as well.
I like that. Hubert, what do you think about that? So they actually load up all the firmware themselves. And of course, you know, the hardware has to be manufactured in China. That's where all the silicon comes from. But they're loading up the encryption hardware that gives you the front door, so they can guarantee that there's no back doors. They actually create the software. They also invite third parties, so they're trying to be transparent. Can you think of anything else they should be doing? Okay.
Good one.
Let me make it an open question to the panelists, Lou or to Curtis. If you were going to be trusting your mobile workers with a device, and let's break it away from Kingston for just a second, what more would you want? You would want the company to be able to guarantee you that, look, we've loaded up the firmware. We have not allowed anyone else to touch our firmware to load in a backdoor. We are doing it here, and we also invite you to come and hack and pound on it to see if you can break it yourself. Is there something else that you want in your secret security sauce? Crickets.
Remote wipe. That's number one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Remote wipe would be number one.
Okay. Me. So the managed solution. All right. Yep, Curtis?
Yep.
I'm thinking some sort of eyelet so that it could be shackled to a user's wrist since physical loss is such a significant source of security issues with portable devices.
Okay.
A device queue, too. Make sure that they only use devices that support these technologies.
Here's an interesting one. Space Quest in the chat room, and actually he's echoing a sentiment that was put out by several of our users, said, well, wait a minute. Why don't you just publish the source code? Let me go with you, Hubert. Is that a viable option?
You know, I don't know. That's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, when you start publishing source code, that means you've got more chances of exposing a vulnerability before you can fix it. I'm actually going to throw this a little back to Lou and ask him to go and throw it at the Active Directory folks. It's like, we already have group policies so that you can, on a workstation, say, no USB storage. Wouldn't it be cool if there was some sort of standard we could say, no unencrypted USB storage? Now, how cool would that be?
Lou, what would have to happen in order to make that a reality?
Just email to the PM, man. And customers asking for it, too, out of the Connect system. Just go out and ask for new features. That's where they get a lot of their features from, connect.microsoft.com.
All right. Curtis, I want to throw back to you really quickly, because I think Lou is probably sidelining. We may have to disconnect him and reconnect him really quickly. But when we think about data security, we're getting a lot of people in the chat room are saying, oh, well, you know what? If I've got really secure data, it just doesn't ever go on a USB drive. Forget it. I broke the USB ports in all my computers because I specifically don't want them to do this. But is that realistic? I mean, because even if you break the ports on their computers at work, if you've got an Office VPN, and probably do, they could always just take it at home, yes?
Right. I think that one of the things that you would really want in the perfect world is some sort of API that exists to bring the portable device and its encryption under a mobile device management regime so that in your device policies, you could specifically allow particular qualities in a removable storage device and disable everything that didn't meet that criteria. That's a tall order. But if we're looking at where things need to be, that's the next logical step. I mean, when we see devices like the ones that Kingston's talking about, we see a number of the critical steps that they've taken for the mobile storage device itself. The next thing we need is some way to interface that with your enterprise management regime so that you can say, I see a mobile storage device that I recognize that I will allow to be part of a device that's on the network. And if I don't see those qualities, then we're going to shut it down. It's a tall order, but I think that's where we really need to go.
I like it. John, I want to give you the last word on this because, well, you're our expert. If we do need a mobile security solution, because, I mean, let's be honest. I understand what Chatroom is saying. Chatroom is saying, look, you keep your secure data at home. You don't put it in a flash drive. Flash drives can be lost. If we're living in the real world where people are going to put data, sensitive data, on devices that can then be lost, what are the best practices? What here's our theoretical situation. As the IT manager of a 10,000-seat enterprise, and you've got workers who work from all different places in planes, at home, et cetera, what is the one policy management change that you would make in order to make sure that data doesn't just walk away?
Sure. Well, as we talked about earlier, a lot of our customers, the way they enforce this is by using their existing endpoint management software has features built into it where they can go out to all their endpoints on the network and put in a block on removable storage. From that point, they can then enable just the Kingston drives, for instance, that they buy from us. Those will lock on to the USB product ID and vendor ID and look for that combination, that code, and enable it. And in many cases for our customers, we have a customization program where we can customize a lot of the features. We can actually generate unique PID, VID for that customer. No one else in the world gets that product ID. So these drives are uniquely registered to that organization. So everything gets blocked. The only thing that will work in those USB ports are the approved USB drives. So the enforcement is actually fairly simple. You had someone mentioned publishing source code out on the internet. These actually use just touch on that subject quickly. AES 256 is a open standard. These implement that standard. So it's out there. It's been a proven standard rather than trying to use a proprietary standard. Sticking with a proven international standard that's been scrutinized worldwide by all the hacks and security experts in the world is a good way to go. And we believe that's why we've implemented the AES standard. If you need further, there's the FIPS validated drives we have. The FIPS process actually goes through to verify that if we say these drives are AES 256, they actually test the algorithms themselves to ensure that those algorithms are performing properly.
I like that. John, we're going to talk about a couple of hot news items, but to close out the show, can we have you stay around for a while?
Sure.
Okay, fantastic.
I'd be glad to.
All right. Now, we do want to cover, this is one of those weird weeks where there have been enough big stories that I want to do a couple more Enterprise Bites. So let me jump into those really quickly. Lou, you might have some interest in this next one, and that is that Microsoft takes yep. down a ClickFraud botnet. I understand that you were actually the person who discovered and disabled the botnet. Is that true?
Right. I don't know if I want to take responsibility for that. Yeah. No, but they did an okay job. They got 40% of taking it down.
Right. So they're not just done yet. Now, for those who don't understand how these botnet works, this was a click fraud botnet. The idea was that it would install, you would somehow get malware installed on your computer that would do a hijack. It would listen to a command and control node, which I believe, Lou, this one, it was also an IRC channel, right? It was, you had these bots just listening to an IRC channel?
Yeah. And it all peer-to-peer based botnet.
Right, exactly. So they're evolving it because they know that using a pure command and control, like one central node, is now too easy to take down. What they would do is they would listen to their botnet network to find out what page they should drive traffic to in order to get some more money through some fraudulent clicks. The story says that they were responsible for $2.7 million a month of fraud. They had infected 1.9 million computers. And if you look at it in the large scheme of things, $2.7 million a month is not a whole lot out of the $20.1 billion spent on online advertising in the first 6 months of 2013. But it's still a sizable number. And more interesting, Lou, I want to throw over to you. This is an interesting story because this was not a typical botnet. I mean, this was a peer-to-peer botnet. How did Microsoft do this? How did they take it down?
Well, I mean, the peer-to-peers are tough because if you take down one node, it's going to go to another node. And it's going to keep doing that over and over again until, one, you put some pressure on them from a law perspective. So I think they filed a civil suit. They took down around 18 to 20, IP addresses, 50 or so domains. But again, it doesn't really matter. And the thing with peer-to-peer is they just can go and set up a new domain, new node, and boom, you're back up and running. It's kind of the key is you just got to put pressure on them and hope that you restrict them in some way. But, again, it's a tough protocol to handle.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's why they moved to it, because if you remember, there were some big takedowns in the past of botnets simply by killing the IRC channel or taking over the IRC channel so you could divert the botnets to a safe target. Cheevert, again, working at a university, I'm going to say that maybe half your computers are infected with some sort of malware.
You know, I don't know. It's getting harder and harder to detect. But what I will say about this, you know, for peer-to-peer stuff, is it requires cooperation. If you don't have lots of ISPs and lots of other exchanges with sensors in them, you're never going to be able to find the signatures as they cross large amounts of real estate. So that's one of the things that need to happen. If you start looking at a lot of what these firewall vendors and IDS and IPS vendors are doing, is they're getting better and better at cooperating and exchanging information between each other, so that when the law enforcement people or, you know, the white hats actually get their act together, they have the ability to go and start tracking people across large spans of continents. And more power to them, man. It's like, I love it. You know, the number of log dumps I get off my UTM firewall is just insane. And it's all attacks. People just script kiddies, botnets, just trying to break in. And I am, for one, am really sick and tired of it.
I like that. Yep, sick and tired. John, the reason why I wanted you in on this conversation is, and this was pointed out in the chat room. Chat room, you are so smart. Chat room, just they know what I'm going to say before I say it. When we think about the spread of malware, one of the more recent and more, I'm going to say fun, even though people are probably using a different word for that, vectors for the spread of malware has been flash drives. You know, the auto-running flash drives, either setting honeypots where I infect a flash drive and I lose it and someone plugs it into his or her computer, or, and we've heard about this, flash drives that are infected with malware from the factory. Can you give us some insights on what has been done to prevent that? I mean, when I buy something and it's in the bubble wrap, you know, it comes like this, I expect that it's not going to be able to infect my computer with anything. And yet that's not always the case. Can you give us some insider information?
Sure. That has been a problem for some USB vendors. Our manufacturing environment, again, we control it. We're very careful to lock down those computers to ensure that all the computers that are involved in the production process, all the machines, are free of viruses. And there's no way for a virus to get into those. What I will say, we talked about the drives. Encryption is a good way to control information that's going out of your networks, to protect that information once it's outside your network. We also have a AV feature built into the drive. So when employees take that drive home, if you buy the drive that has the antivirus software on it, they plug it into their computer. Who knows what they have on their computer, what type of AV protection, who's been using it. But this will provide additional antivirus protection for that drive. So when they come back into your networks, it gives you further assurance, expands your antivirus protection on those drives before they return home with something.
Yeah. All right, one last story before we send you on your merry way. And I believe, Cheevert, you're going to be in the driver's seat for most of this one. You may have heard that Apple bought Topsy, which is an analytics firm. Topsy was really good at taking a Twitter feed and teasing out bits of information, not just how many times did someone tweet about my company, but it could actually find sentiment. Was it a happy text? Was it a negative tweet? Was it something that maybe indicated a buying preference? Now, you think that this purchase of Topsy and Apple's inclusion of iBeacons in their next set of features is all part of a move towards retail analytics. First of all, can you tell us what that is and why this story revolves around that?
Okay, first and foremost, it's not new. SAP has actually been selling this service for quite a while. They're just not making a really big deal out of it. But retail analytics is all about being able to track the movement of customers, of your patrons within the space that you control. So what the so-called golden fleece, you know, the holy grail of retail analytics is, I want to be able to go and watch and through some sort of anonymizing process. I want to know, how long did someone stand in front of my storefront staring in the window before they came in? I don't necessarily want to know who they are. I just want to know, is my storefront effective? I want to be able to put sensors, say, in the end caps of product aisles, say at like large stores. I want to find out where the traffic is. Since my wife is a librarian, one of the conversations that came up, retail analytics is actually also really important for places like museums, libraries, lots of public areas where you want to be able to track patron movement within the area. So things like iBeacon or using Wi-Fi for retail analytics is actually a very, very big deal and has the potential for dramatically increasing the value of public services as long as we're careful about the big brother factor.
Right. Lou, I want to throw over to you because, well, I believe the very first time you ever came on Twiat, you were talking about Microsoft CRM. And CRM is evolving to include things like retail analytics, right? I mean, if you're trying to keep a relationship with your customers, you're probably tracking what they're doing in social, whether or not they're ready to buy, whether or not they're happy or sad with your brand. Is this something Microsoft is doing, and can you talk about it? If you can't talk about it, just stare at the camera and smile.
No. We have a product called Market Pilot. It does a lot of that type of thing where it does sentiment analysis, and it now analyzes social streams and data streams and all different types of streams, and helps to kind of bring that data to CRM. And there's several other little companies too. There's a company a good friend of mine started called Azuqua, AZUQUA.com. Kind of allows companies to make use of customer interactions with that company, whether it be big data or social networks, and kind of bring that data in and do something with it. You know, from Twitter, Twilio, or Facebook, and sentiment analysis, bringing it into other systems like CRM or other other your proprietary systems, and put actions on those things. I think it's really important to do those types of things in order to kind of stay up with what customers want, what customers are doing, and how customers are interacting with your product.
Yeah. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. We've got Ye in the chat room, who I think is trying to troll us, but actually came up with a pretty good point, and that it's just another way to trick people into buying stuff they don't need rather than telling them about the stuff that they could actually use. Do you see it that way? Because, I mean, retail analytics, yes, it is a way to increase sales, but it's also a way to more closely target what it is that you need. Rather than the impulse buy, it could be monitoring your feed to say, look, you've been complaining a lot about your computer being slow. Here are computers that actually would fit your buying pattern, your price range, and your requirements.
Well, in one sense, it goes back to something that Brian said when he talked about retailers wanting to get all the information they could about customers who are within the environment they control. The analytics on social media is, in a very real way, an effort to expand those boundaries, because retailers have understood that if you wait until someone comes into your store to start telling them either what you have or what you want them to buy, that it's too late. You have to reach them long before they ever set foot in your retail establishment, whether that's an online presence, a website, or a brick-and-mortar store. So, yes, this is absolutely part of the effort to convince people that you know what they need to buy. In that way, it's no different than pretty much all of the marketing and advertising that's gone on for the last century, at least. In another sense, you're quite right. By more closely targeting what people's needs are, what they've already stated their preferences to be, you can make it easier to encourage them to see what you have on offer as the solution to a problem that, until you help them, they might not even know they have. So it really is both a new intrusion, because you're looking more closely into their life outside the walls of your store, and to help, because you really are, for reasons that are entirely your own, trying to understand them better and more closely target them with what you have. It can be seen as a win-win. It can be seen as a new intrusion. It depends a lot on what you think of the modern world of capitalism and consumerism.
John, I want to throw over to you, although I think this is far afield from what we brought you onto the program for. So I want to give you the option to just look at the camera, and we talked about this before the show. You could just say USB managed drives.
USB managed drives.
Fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, you know what? You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. I asked my mom, and she never lies to me. But I want to thank my panelists for coming on. This has actually been a lot of fun. We don't do these, you know, kind of end-user focused shows a lot. And when we do, I really do enjoy it. I want to start with you, T-Bert. Where should the Twilight Riot find you? I mean, I know you're touring California right now, but you've got some fun stuff coming up.
Yeah, I'm starting to work on trying to put the tools together to start beating up firewalls again. It's been a little while since I've broken some stuff, and you know, I'm losing control. I need to do it again. And I've been getting a big flurry of people following me on Twitter. I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and love to hear from you.
And you know what? I think we really need to get you a drop cam, because you are the only network tester I know who actually managed to melt a switch.
Actually, I didn't. Well, yeah, I did.
You did. Yeah.
I also set one on fire.
Fire, good. Fire tells you that the bits are working. Speaking of the bits working, let's go over to Curtis. Curtis, hopefully you can get on your plane. Hopefully you can get over to Texas to Dell World. But if you don't, where should the Twilight Riot find you?
Well, I am, as always, in enterprise efficiency. I've already had some contact with a couple of our Twilight listeners about being guests on upcoming episodes of E2 Radio. We would encourage anybody out there who is an IT executive who has an interesting story to tell, or just is willing to talk to us about what they're doing in enterprise IT. I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a direct message on Twitter at KG4GWA. Or shoot me an email, franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com. I'd love to hear from you.
Always a pleasure to see you, Curtis. Now, someone else I'm really happy that he could make it onto the show is Mr. Lou Maresca. Lou, you know, it's not just because you work for Microsoft. It's not just because you're helping me out by being the guest code warrior on Coding 101. But, you know, you really are a true enterprise nerd. And wait, did you make that whiteboard for us? This
wait, hey, that's my selection sort algorithm back there.
That's a little bit suspicious. But tell the Twilight Riot what you're up to and where they can find you.
Sure. So I'm working on Dynamics CRM, and it's all about finding, acquiring, retaining your customers. And we're trying to bring it to as many devices as we can. And I also want to pitch, since we talked about Topsy, my good friend has his company, Azuqua, AZUQUA.com, just allowing companies to bring customer interactions and that big dynamic data from these companies, other systems, into other, you know, allowing you to do something with it, making it actionable. And I think it's important for all companies to kind of jump on that and make use of customer data in order to make better decision making and help those customers out. So check it out.
Thank you, Lou. And we'll definitely have you back. John Turpening of Kingston, thank you so very much. This is one of those things where people tend to think that, oh, vendors are just going to talk about their stuff. But this was important enough that I thought that we should have you on. Thank you for dropping the knowledge about managed data, about secure data, about encrypted flash drives. Where should people go if they want to find out more about either these products, the ones that, you know, we showed off in the studio, or about anything else Kingston may have to offer?
Well, if they go to kingston.com, they'll see a list of all our products off our company website. Secure USB is right up near the top there. They can click on that and have information on the range of security products, and you have it right there. That'll take them to the secure page. And there's also places there where they can contact us if they have any questions.
Fantastic. And I believe we actually have already an engagement to bring Kingston back to talk about securing and managing enterprise-class SSDs. So I can't wait. Thank you so very much for being on
the show.
Thank you. You know who else I thank? I thank you. And it's not just because I'm stuck here sitting to a man in an angry bird's hat. It's because you are the ones who make Twilight so much fun to do each and every single week. And for that, I want to give you something. I want to give you a way to download each and every single episode of This Week of Enterprise Tech into your device of choice. If you right now go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat, which I'm sure Brian will bring up because he was caught a little off guard there, you can find drop-down menus that will let you select feeds to get every episode of Twiat dropped into your iPad, your iPhone, your Android tablet, or phone, your device, your laptop, your PC, whatever it might be, even your zombie Zune, we're going to give it to you because that's just how we roll. Also, you can find us on YouTube. That's right. We've got a YouTube page. Did you know that? Actually, not a lot of people do. Please go and subscribe because we want to start pushing out some really cool content, including some hangouts, which I know we've been promising for almost a year, but we're actually going to start doing them. Go to youtube.com/Twiat and you'll be able to find not just all of our episodes, but also the individual segments. If you want to find out what happened on the last Stuff My IT Guy Says, it's there. If you want to see what Cheebert is doing with fiber and a pro tip, pro gear, it's going to be in there. So drop on by. Don't mind the hat. Yeah. You can also find me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes of Twiat, and you'll also be able to make comments about what has happened in the past, and even find out that my shoes are running kind of thin. Thank you so very much for bringing that up, Ryan. That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. One last plea. Please go to twit.tv/survey because we need your input to find out how to make Twiat more of the user experience that you want. If you go to twit.tv/survey, it's about 5 minutes and it is invaluable information to help create Twiat in the image of Chat Realm. Finally, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. I want to thank Brian, who stepped in as our stellar TD, and he did a great job. In fact, I think Brian gets a golf clap. Very good. Very good. Yes. And afterwards, I'll make fun of him because I must follow every compliment with an insult. I also want to thank our super producer, Karsten, everyone here in the chat room and the Brick House who makes the show possible, along with Kathy Chi and Cyberdog for being in the studio audience. I'm Father Robert Balasair reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise,
just keep quiet.